Hannah Murray on TRE in the afternoon.
Out the bank, you got Steve outside, count a full pack, and everything's cool and everything's smooth.
Hey, that's smooth.
I walk into the teller, I give her the letter, she gives me the loot, the puckered up lips and a wink that I found cute. And I said, baby, 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 is there some karmic G love thing happening here, baby, or what? By that time, that's happening with the hands, and it's time to blow, you know. So out the door we go, back to the ride, Steve inside in the lot, and off the drive. See, I hurt my lower lumbar. You know we never get far riding around in a stolen police car. So we dropped it off and piled in the caddy. Steve was driving, cause I had to talk to my man.
I don't know anything about any setup. You can torture me all you want.
Torture you, that's a good idea. I like that one.
Punking the crowd, man, I'm still standing up straight. So we pull these jobs, make a little money. No one gets hurt if they don't act funny. On the way to the yacht, we almost got caught. Fast shooting mailbox, you know where the cops is, yeah. They had to duck the donuts adjacent from the phone, whose mailbox fast that just exploded. They gave chase from our man Steve's an ace, and we lost those brothers with haste. We cast it off, and along we went off from Utah to an island resort we rented.
Sunshine, need you cool. Are you cool? I am cool.
Running around, robbing banks, all whacked up with Scooby Snacks. Running around, robbing banks, all whacked up with Scooby Snacks. Running around, robbing banks, all whacked up with Scooby Snacks.
There we are, fun-loving criminals and Scooby Snacks. I managed to find the clean version because joining us on the line now is Huey Morgan, who grew up on the Lower East Side of New York City in the 70s and 80s, then toured the world with fun-loving criminals, including the Pyramid Stage at Glastonbury in 1999. Scooby Snacks was their biggest hit, which hit the charts, hit the charts around the world in the mid-90s. He's now an award-winning BBC broadcaster. His memoir, The Fun-Loving Criminal, begins in the early 90s when he struggles to return to normal life after his time in the Marines. Welcome to the show, Huey.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm here in my studio in the basement of my home in Bath, and it's lovely to be speaking with you.
Oh, it's great to be speaking with you. How do you feel when you hear that song, and has your reaction kind of changed over the years?
I don't think I hear that. Whenever people mention that song, especially if I'm in the basement of the studio in my townhouse, I go, well, thank you very much for really liking that song, because it kind of got me this house. You know what I mean? So I'm very appreciative. I have so much gratitude when it comes to the early Fun Loving Criminal stuff, because it was kind of the story of my life to a large extent. And when I make connections with people, even all these years later, I find it always really, it's always really cool, and it's always really positive.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm waving this thing around. It's probably not so positive.
Oh, no, what did you do?
I was washing up, and I nicked a tendon in my pinky here, and it's the flexor tendon that makes the pinky go like this. And as a guitar player, that's like the worst thing to get. Oh, well, I'll tell you, it was a pinky, so it's not that bad, and everything's going to be okay. But I had surgery this week, so I have this little kind of gammy hand for the next couple, so which is cool. I get everybody in my house. I got two young kids and my wife right now. We're going, you okay, man? You okay?
Yeah, but I bet your wife's worried that it's put you off washing up. You're never going to do it again now.
Oh, yeah, of course. My lawyer's already sent some letters to her.
Brilliant. So I'm really interested to know how you got into music. I feel like it's kind of in your blood, but how did it first happen for you, do you think?
Well, I mentioned in the book, and it's interesting because when I was a young kid, I was a product of a single person household. It was my mother and I. My father left us at a very early age, and my mother worked. She worked 40 plus hours a week. She was a writer as well as I turned into be. I think I got in the family business because of her. And in doing so, I had a lot of free time, and being a loner and kind of feeling a little isolated from stuff and having, you know, feelings of that isolation really kind of becoming to a head when I became pubescent, for lack of a better term, music touched me. And it does with a lot of people. And in doing so, it made me realize that some of the things I was hearing were some of the things I was feeling. And I connected with that. And I realized that maybe I could connect with what I was feeling with other people and I wouldn't feel so alone. So I started getting into listening to different types of music. I was lucky enough to be in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in the 70s and the 80s, where music was just going crazy. And I got into music because I was trying to make connections with people. And I still do that. I'm doing this with this book as well. But the idea that I had found that I wasn't alone was something that I think propelled me to make music my life, because I found in that world of music, there wasn't as much judgment as there was outside of it.
Mm. And with the lyrics that you wrote, particularly in the early days, but throughout your career, they've always been really personal. Did you kind of feel like it was a bit of sort of therapy at the time, being able to get out your feelings of your childhood and your upbringing?
Well, that's a great question. And yeah, absolutely. I think initially when I started, and all these songs, just to back it up a little bit, I've been a writer since I was about 10 or 11. And what I used to do is I used to try to write how I felt, and I'd write stories. And all these songs are 2,000 or 3,000 word stories that are whittled down into verses and then made to rhyme and then, you know, fit a melody to it and see if people will dance, right? So I've been doing this for a long time, and all these songs had to be my perspective, you know, and your own personal perception is interesting. When you start writing, the idea of looking at things through other people's, from other people's perspective, is super important. And I teach my kids this, where, you know, perception is where you think it is, but perspective is wherever you need it to be. So I try to do things, especially with the stories that I wrote early on, where I made them songs, like the Fun Loving Criminal songs. I tried to, when I did, I guess, you know, boil them down to song form, I tried to make them things that were universal in theme, you know, not necessarily framed. I mean, obviously you can frame a lot of things in different ways, but the universal themes underlying them were human emotions and things that we all go through in daily life.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful in music. A lot of the time people relate to the lyrics, and it's something that they can identify with. And aside from it being a good beat and a great melody, if the lyrics you can identify with them, that's huge. That's what people fall in love with, I think.
Well, it helps. And also, and not to say the more ambiguous, the better. Sometimes the more specific, the better. You know, I have a thing for Rick Rubin, right? I always thought Rick Rubin had this like Oracle of Delphi thing happening, right? And he mentions that when you do create stuff, don't polish it. The thing that makes it unique and makes it something that would connect with somebody is its imperfections, is its authenticity, the fact that it does just come from you, like a good conversation would when you meet someone in person. You know, good art can do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I have to ask you about Scooby Snacks. I remember when it came out and we were all debating and we were all debating what a Scooby snack was. And we were like, are they hash cakes? Is it ecstasy? It's Valium, I just found out.
Yeah, it's in the book. Yeah, we had a guy who was a security guard in one of the nightclubs we worked in, and his dad was a pharmacist, and he'd walk around the club before it opened, knowing we were all very nervous because it was a very heavy hip hop club. And it may sound a little bit flippant speaking about this on European radio, but there were a lot of guns going off, right? And if there wasn't a couple shots put in the ceiling by 2:30, the security guys would do it just to break the tension. So we would all be very, you know, as as they say in Yiddish, we were cavelling just to get out of there, right? So this guy would walk around and go, anybody want any Scooby snacks? And that's the impetus of the song. And then obviously after taking a couple, I looked around and go, imagine robbing this place.
Oh, amazing. And
you know what it is? And all that comes from, because I remember I told my son that exact story and he goes, but dad, like, why would you think, well, wouldn't it be cool to rob this place? I go, kid, you don't know it. Do your ancestry DNA. We're lineage. We're from pirates. I'm from the Morgan pirate family, man. I got a pirate tattoo. We are pirates, man. Pillaging is my middle name. Come on. So, no, but it's funny because a lot of these flights of fancy, you know, this fictitious way things could be, is one of the things I always really loved when I would read stuff. Like if I read Bulgakov and The Master and Margarita, you know, which is obviously a flight of fancy, but it did root itself in some really fundamental ideas that we needed to discuss. I mean, granted, it was, you know, 19th century Russia. We weren't discussing much there, but in and of itself, those ideas kind of transcend the joke or the frame. And if there's something there that has a really authentic flavor or texture, people are drawn to it. Because especially nowadays, man, we see everything. We know when people are lying before they even start talking, just the looks in their faces. We have memes that we use when we know people are full of shit. It's just like we are now I think as a world society, priding ourselves finally on picking up on the boondoggle and all the, you know, because you know that the worst thing about getting hoodwinked is admitting you got hoodwinked. You know, yeah. What I mean? Like recently, some friend of mine who's like very conspiracy oriented sent me this really cool letter, and it was a letter from like MI6 going, yeah, it came from that place in Wuhan. Sorry. It was like a public letter. And because everybody was hoodwinked for the last couple of years, everybody's like, yeah. Let's not just blow it out of proportion because it makes everybody look bad.
Exactly. Don't talk about it. Just pretend.
That's probably one of the problems with society as a whole nowadays. But I think I went way off the topic of what we were talking about.
It's fine. It's all good. I wanted to ask you about the fun loving criminal, the criminal side of things. I don't want you to talk about anything that you don't want to talk about or that you're
not. You're not a cop.
Exactly.
You're not a judge. I can go beep and just turn this thing off.
Absolutely. It's all good. So I know you're in the Marines, and when you came back from the Marines, it was a struggle kind of getting back into society. You wanted to
civilians are the most undisciplined, sloppy. Oh my God. Like, I mean, it's unbelievable how, oh, anyway, go on. Sorry.
Well, no, I just wanted to ask you about that time.
Like your safety, you're so entitled. Oh my God. Yeah, I could go on. I could write a book about this.
You're good. Can you tell us a bit about that time and what you were struggling with, why it was difficult?
Well, you know, one of the great things about us Marines is that we love putting a little humor slant on everything. And I talk about it in the book in ways that are funny. And I talk about it in the book that are ways that are quite serious. But I think one of the biggest problems was going to the Marines. I finally found people that saw the world how I saw it. And it was lovely. It was like, I have a friend who's in the Jungle Brothers, and he saw me out one time. He's like, dude, seeing you, it's like seeing a freaking panda. You know, like I'm a panda, you're a panda, we're in the wild. Look, it's another panda. We don't see pandas often, right? So when you find a whole 200,000 pandas and you're all hanging out together and you're blowing shit up and jumping out of planes and having fun, da, 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 da. When you leave that, you're kind of like, oh man, where are all the pandas, bro? And then you go out and you find a bunch of sheep and there are no pandas. No one's got teeth. Everybody's entitled and wrapped in bubble wrap. And just, you know, their opinions are based on they're like seat cushions. You know, their opinions are based on the last person who farted on them. And this is kind of like how I saw society, you know?
Yeah.
And frankly, I was disappointed enough to write a song called I Can't Get With That about this whole thing, right? So this is another thing I wrote. Long stories about how I felt, and I boiled them down to my first album. And I had so much fun really looking back on it, doing this book, going, and a damn thing changed. It's ironic in that regard, but I think one of the things we don't do as a society is admit when we've kind of done something wrong, because it kind of, it with our ego. And I think our collective ego as a society needs to just be maybe reeled in a little bit. You know, I think we, because of the exponential technological and intellectual growth of a species over such a short period of time, we're left with this, big dick energy. That's not really, it doesn't really add up once you get under the sheets. You know what I mean? So we maybe should just kind of be a little bit more humble. Like our man said, you know, be humble, sit down. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm not talking about everybody, obviously, but you know,
yeah,
that was one of the things I found. That's one of the things I found difficult with what was going on. Mm. Consider that, you know, it was all at their fingertips.
Yeah. And writing this book, was it a real way of going back over your life and your career and your experiences, and really good to kind of remember it all and get it all down, even the difficult bits?
Yeah, it's not like I have dementia and I'm kind of freaking that I'm going to forget all this good shit. It was more along the lines of, I've been writing, as I've been mentioning, that I write about everything. I've been writing since I was very young. Not journaling, but almost novelizing, which is kind of weird. It's a weird way of looking at the world. Like, it's almost as if the world could be a little bit different. It would be like this, and that's what I would write. And in doing so, I've written a lot of, now they're books, right? And I was recently connected with a literary agent over at the Blair Partnership. He's one of the big guys. His name's Rory Scarfe. And we were talking about my writing style. And he's like, this is great. You write great. And I said, well, how am I going to get this thing out there? He says, well, you know, everybody wants to know your story. And I said, well, you know, just in general, I'm just going to let you know a little background. I'm a more personal man than a public man. I don't have famous friends. And if I did have any dalliances, they are mine, private affair, and I don't talk about them, never have, and I won't. And as relaying this to him, who's an agent in the book world, I could see him kind of going, oh, it's a little, I guess, maybe a little bit disappointing in knowing that that's not the kind of book that I would write. But then when I said to him, look, if I could write a book about the specific period of time in my life from when I was a homeless Marine veteran getting off a bus with a sea bag on my back looking for a joint, right, to then me ending the book somewhere where everybody then begins to see me and understand me and know me, maybe superficial as it is being a pop star or whatever the hell I was back then. But I thought that was a really transformative period of my life. You know, I went from one thing, and if you read the book, you'll see there are quite a few protagonists. There's the mafia, there's the music industry, as we all know, but there's also me, my own mental health. And these three things also alloyed with an ambition to try to transcend the cards I was dealt and the situation I found myself in. I was helped along the way greatly by a lady named Joyce, who I talk about affectionately in the book, someone who let me know, as simple as it sounds now, that I could change the way my mind worked, and I could change the way I thought about certain things in past and present and future. So when I decided to write this book, I wanted to write it in the style how my fiction is. So if you read the book, you'll maybe realize, wow, this is a really cool way of writing a book of this nature. It's also written in a very kind of visual sense, where I'm a big movie fan, and I always thought that things in my mind, especially all my favorite books, and I mentioned Bulgakov before, I always thought that would make a fantastic movie. And now in the advent of computer graphics, I think we should try it. Hello, Hollywood. But that's how I wanted to approach this book, because I wanted it to lay a foundation of two sorts. I wanted people to understand, number one, who I was and why it was different when my band came out than other bands. I wasn't available for the exploitation. I wasn't someone who really relished being around other vassals of, you know, celebrity. I wasn't something I liked. And the reason was because I was trying to do something else. I was really concerned about keeping myself alive. And I know I talk about that maybe a little bit flippantly here because it's a podcast, but I had a lot of problems with seeing a reason to continue living. And that goes with a lot of things that I don't discuss in the book. And frankly, that's great, because it's my life and I, in my book, and I wrote it, and I could talk about what I'd like to talk about. And I think the theme that I try to get through there while navigating all these really difficult things is that to find things out about yourself, good and bad, is a step in the right direction, and you don't have to be alone in doing so. And there are people out there that would really love to help.
Mm. Yeah. Great, you know, message.
And going back to being a songwriter, I'd like it to all rhyme and have people dance to it. So I wanted to make it entertaining as well. So to read, obviously, there's some funny dialogue in there and there's some funny jokes. And, you know, as you take five or six stories and squash them together, there's also some interesting outcomes as well.
Yeah. So would you say that you struggled with the fame side of things when it was happening? You were enjoying the music, you were enjoying the performing, but the fame side of things, not so much?
It wasn't a struggle. It's just that I lived in New York City, right? Where no one gives a f- who you are, right? Where I was growing up, where I grew up on Avenue C and 6th Street, Keith Richards lived on like 7th Street and Avenue B. And he'd walk around all over the place. People were like, oh, it's him. No one would bother him. Granted, he probably hit them, but no one cared. It was New York City. We don't care in New York City. Plus, the band Fun Loving Criminals was not extremely popular in the United States. And that combination was great for me because I would go and do my tours and do my promo and do whatever I had to do to make a living being a musician so I could get back in the studio, which was in the book. I talk about all this on stage stuff and all this MC and all this, you know, stage craft people so lovingly refer to me with. It's all just a dalliance for me to get back into the studio where I really, really want to be. So I guess I forgot the question actually at this point, but I think what you're trying to ask me was more about I completely forgot.
Fame. It was about fame, just talking about.
Because yeah. I had avoided. It was never something that really entered into the equation of being a musician. Like I mentioned, exactly. That's why I got sidetracked because I didn't think about it. It was be on stage, get off stage, you can get in the studio. At no point, what was it? What am I wearing to the Met Gala? Or was that Donatella Versace? I'm a regular guy. And I mentioned it in the book that, you know, it's not something to be a star. It's something to be an artist, you know, and that's all I really wanted to do. I always just wanted to be an artist. I wanted to be a session guitar player. You know, this whole Lee Singer shit happened only because the other dudes were talking about their dick and cars too much. And I just thought that was stupid. So we didn't have him in the band, you know? Mm.
I have to say one of my favorite songs is Daylight. I'm quite friendly with Rowetta, who I've met quite a few times over the years here in Spain. And I interviewed her when Daylight came out. And that was that fun song to do. Quite a different style, I thought.
Yeah, that was during a period of time with the band that I had very little to do with them. So, yeah, I didn't really have anything to do with Rowetta singing on that track. It's a Georgie Fame song, I remember, right? Yeah,
It was just a few years before you left, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there was a whole lot of stuff going on there. Yeah.
Okay. And do you miss any of it, or is it just a chapter of your life that's done and you're on to new things now?
Yeah, I don't really miss those guys or that situation at all.
No, fair enough. And you're happy in the UK doing lots of radio and stuff.
I am. The ankle monitor has been released, so I could be anywhere I want. I used to be there now.
Brilliant. Well, it's been great to chat with you, Huey. Thank you so much for joining us. If listeners want to get a copy of The Fun Loving Criminal, a memoir, it's out now. It's available on our website and it's by Huey Morgan, who we've been chatting with. Huey, thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time and, buenas tardes.
Buenas tardes.